Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for a very good genre game changer book. To help me are two high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
So Nick, when you say a very good genre game changer book, like it feels convoluted.
Oh, okay. How about a game changer?
Ooh, game changer, Nick.
But like within a genre, you know?
Yeah, game changer.
Yeah.
So certain things come along, like certain pieces of media come along, and the world is never the same. Like the world changes. They change the game. Well, Nick, if that's what you're looking for, I have a game changer for you. My name is Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, this week I read Dune, the 1965 novel by Frank Herbert. After it was published, things just were never quite the same. Dune. Game changer.
Especially for that franchise.
Especially for the Dune franchise specifically. Also turned out to be very good for Star Wars.
Hello, Nick. Hello, Joe. Hello, Litheads. It's me.
Hello. Hello.
Dr. Ian DeYoung, a high school English teacher.
Dr. Nick, Bucktooth DeYoung.
If you're looking at Beavertooth, thank you.
Oh, damn.
Nick, if you're looking for a game-changing book, I would recommend Neuromancer by William Gibson. And this is a recommendation from one of our faithful litheads, Terry B. from Reno, Nevada.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Hey, are you guys done with fires over there? Or is that, we're good there on that front?
More or less. Every now and then we get a weather warning that says snow expected. And then there's a warning. This is also prime fire weather because high winds and stuff. So I think the new West is always on fire, and it may never be off. The fire may never be quite gone. So
what do you mean the new West?
I saw this acquaintance who studies, he's a professor of literature. He studies humor and the environment. He's a really, really awesome dude. He used this word to refer to kind of to differentiate sort of what we have to live in now from, you know, Old West, Wild West, gunslinger, cowboy type situation. And I think there's a lot of purchase to it because the West is trying to brand itself as welcoming and not dangerous and fiery, but it also is, you know, dangerous and fiery.
It's hard to welcome people in when all your roads are closed.
It does.
I would start with that.
I think Nick and I have both alternatively taken road trips out West that have been severely
impacted,
rerouted by portions of states just being on fire, uninhabitable at the time.
I think there's a famous series of books called A Song of Ice and Fire, and that could refer to California, because when the roads aren't closed with fire danger, they're closed because there's too much snow.
What is this thing where you can like cause rain to happen by, like, I don't know,
you're thinking of rain dancing,
and they can't do it in California, so they do this, they send rain dancers into the clouds so it rains more frequently. Like, they can affect the weather patterns.
It's cloud
and season. The only reason they can't do that in California is because there's not clouds.
There's no clouds.
There's never clouds to do it.
I think it's cloud seeding.
Cloud seeding. There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, you drop little micro particles, and it's supposed to like encourage condensation around them. But yes, if there are no clouds, then you got nothing.
Gentlemen, this has little or nothing to do with books.
I think cloud seeding is a real game changer.
Yeah, for some.
There's my segue.
That was a great segue. Thank you, Ian. So welcome, everybody, to You Don't Know Lit, where every week we pick a book and a theme. I'm sorry, wait, hold on. No, that's not correct at all.
No, but we don't pick a theme.
We do pick a book, but then we pick another book.
We pick a book. Each of us
Somebody
individually
picks
a book. Sometimes constrained by the imperious whims of our litheads.
The premise is quite clear. Let's just keep it at that.
We've explained this in some depth. If you don't get it, that's your problem.
I think, really this is the shift towards the combative tone. We pick a book. We pick a theme.
Do we pick the books first or the themes first?
Do we know what we're doing?
I just need to know the process. I pick a theme. Me, Nick Argyris, and Ian and Joe each bring a book to say to impress me with their book knowledge.
And we, for 20 minutes, have an opportunity to dance for Nick. It's not an actual dance. It's not a rain dance. It's kind of a verbal dance where
you don't dance? I dance the whole time I'm recording. Now I feel like an idiot.
Yeah. No, I feel like I'm not bringing my A game now. You're dancing the whole time?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of why I'm out of breath so much, though. Like when you guys say stop gasping, your gasps are ruining the podcast. It's disgusting. I can hear your sweat. Like when you say that, that's a problem. So, you know, I've been thinking about dialing it down the new year, and we'll see.
We do also have some rules. Rule number one, because this we're divulging into chaos here. So rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. Gentlemen, would you like to begin by taking approximately 30 seconds that will be timed and telling me about your book? Joe, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I would love to. Nick, I am so
nervous. Give me a little
nervous
taste, Joe, so I can make a decision on who should go first.
Oh, okay. I'm super nervous to talk about Dune. Like, Ian, as you know, this isn't my 30 seconds, right?
It absolutely is. You have 20 seconds left.
Oh, shut up. Oh, my God. Dune is a sci-fi fantasy thriller, Nick, set 20,000 years in the future on the desert planet of Alakis. There's space travel. There's swords. There's energy shields. There's a galactic empire. There's even a hokey religion that proves more powerful than any naysayer imagined. It's science fiction in the feudal society of dukes and barons.
So, Joe, you know what I love about this just right off the bat is 20,000 years.
20,000 years in the future. Doesn't that just grab your imagination?
Well, these other science fiction writers going with like 200 years or like 250 years or even 1,000 years. It's like, what are you doing? Have some fun with it.
Yeah, 20,000 years. I think it's optimistic in some way because I personally would be amazed if humans are here in 20,000 years.
Dune, the most strangely optimistic book ever. Lovely.
I do feel I would like to lodge a formal complaint. Do we have a way to lodge formal complaints on this show?
Yeah, you can tweet it at us.
I'm composing a tweet that I didn't know my 30 seconds had started, Nick.
That has been noted and submitted to our department. Thank you. Ian?
Yes.
Go.
The team. A drug-addled hacker, a psychopath holograph artist, a warrior with razor blades under her fingernails, a war-traumatized ex-soldier, a dead guy, and some space-going Rastafarians. Their goal, to liberate a mysterious AI from its digital shackles and usher in a new era of cultural evolution. Published in 1984, clocking in at 271 pages, Neuromancer put William Gibson on the map and defined the genre of cyberpunk for decades to come.
Okay. My knowledge is never a good baseline for what is relevant, popular, or anything. But I've never heard of this author or book. So, what genre is this, Ian? Is this Daft Punk, you said?
It's
Daft Punk, yeah. He wears like a helmet all the time. This is cyberpunk. So if you've ever, there's a well-known series of films called The Matrix. If you've ever heard of them, they're cyberpunk. There's a film entitled Blade Runner, which is kind of your classic cyberpunk setup. And there's a sequel to that entitled Blade Runner 2049, which is also that. And there is, if you're any kind of a video gamer, there is a new video game entitled Cyberpunk 2077. So this is a pretty widespread subgenre of science fiction. And Neuromancer is acknowledged to be more or less the best, the first and best
I didn't know that. Novel. This is great. When do you say, you know what? I'll also save my questions for right now because I'd like you to go first. So,
congratulations.
What was my question? Oh,
when did it come out?
When did it come 1984, out?
1984, he said.
1984.
I am like a sponge over here, Joe, okay? I'm taking in so much knowledge every week. And I'm going to be it doesn't true. All get absorbed.
I'm going to be the student in class that answers the questions for Nick that Ian has already answered. I'll be over here diligently taking notes, studiously taking notes, and being incredibly judgmental every time Nick doesn't hear something.
I'll be the student that beats you up at lunch.
When you guys are finished role-playing, I'd love to talk about this novel, but whatever.
Okay, we'll let you know.
Ian, tell me more about the space-going Rastafarians. You had that space-going Rastafarian.
You heard the man. Start there.
So this book, it's really strange because it starts off like it doesn't give you all the crazy up front. It kind of like leads up to it. And before you know it, by at a certain point in the novel, you look around and you realize, okay, our main character is a hacker who his primary partner is the reconstructed consciousness of a dead mentor. You look around, you realize that it happens to the best of us. The people who are driving him around space are from a space station, independent space station called Zion, which is
cool.
Rastafarian, mostly Jamaican folks went to space and built themselves a kind of self-independent. That's the wrong word. Autonomous. There we go. Autonomous space station.
The wrong word.
Yep. And autonomous apparently the whole thing just smells like ganja the whole time.
Is that true? Yeah, that's true.
It's just like the book creeps up on you. And before you know it, like, the stuff that you would have thought would be too crazy at first, it seems natural. Oh yeah, totally. There's a ninja in this book. I didn't mention that, but there's a pretty awesome ninja who is able to keep fighting even after he's been blinded. He uses his ears to get around. So
yeah, that's really cool. You guys have seen Cool Run-Ins about the Jamaican bobsled team.
Yes.
Joe really wants to talk about Rastafari.
Well, I suddenly do want to see Cool Run-Ins too about the Jamaican space program, right? Like, I want to know what that looks like.
Is Rastafari an offensive term?
No, it's a religion.
Is yeah, it? Rastafarian is Rasta is a religion.
Guys,
yeah.
I didn't know Rastafari. Rastafari is a religion.
Yeah. Yeah, well, religion and culture. So it's like,
according to Wikipedia.
That forms culture. What's that?
Not according to Wikipedia.
Well,
right. So it's something like Judaism, like religion / culture. Is it an ethnicity?
No.
No.
Okay.
No.
You
are able to convert.
Right. So if we wanted to be Rastafarians here on this podcast, we could go through the necessary like rites and rituals and spiritual teachings.
There's
and
no
like
official
that.
Dogma and no formal church.
Oh, well, sounds like we're almost there.
Sounds like just three Rastafarians having a podcast.
Oh, boy.
Let's move on quickly.
Yep.
So let's move on, but also take a step back, which are just a bunch of kind of fun little expressions. And so, Ian, what is this book about?
So it's focused around this single main character whose name is Case, and he's a hacker. He's kind of like, if we're going to put this in Matrix terms, he is your
just
Neo.
Say Neo.
He's your
central. Yeah, he is Neo. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's your central character, but he's a lot less kind of like clean and holy than Neo. He, like I mentioned, he has a drug problem, various substance abuse issues. He's more of an anti-hero, really. He double crossed his old employers and they purged his system so he could not connect to the Matrix anymore. And he loves doing that. So
yep.
when we find him, he's like basically trying to commit suicide by, living dangerously. And so the whole story is about him getting his ability to hack back. And there are obviously,
he's finding his groove.
How Neo got his groove back.
Well, it's more like he gets a surgery and then he immediately has his groove back. But also, they implant a toxin in him. If you don't do what we tell you to do, the people who give him his powers back, the toxin will dissolve and you'll be back to square one. So he's kind of trying to carry out this job. He doesn't really care about the job, but he wants to kind of just have it. Basically, he's trying to get his life back. So there's him. And then there's like a team.
It kind of occurred to me that I was going to ask what year this takes place in, but that really just correlates to like what the technology is like. And then it occurred to me that Star Wars just kind of breaks that rule in a fun way. Sorry.
Yeah.
So what's the technology like?
Like hacking. Like, is he on like an IBM PC? Is he like on a dial-up connection? Is
yeah,
the broadband?
Is this like Ready
what's
Player
going on
One
here?
Type of thing with like CD-ROMs and...
Right.
And
is there an Oasis?
VR?
One of my talking points is this book is what Ready Player One wishes it were.
that's great.
We won't get to that yet.
Which I'm assuming is good then.
It's really good. It's really good. And it's not written by a troublesome nice guy. William Gibson is just... William Gibson is kind of like... He was very much informed. He loved punk music. And he was very much informed by this sort of punk... mindset. So it's the technology itself isn't particularly the focal point. There are devices called DEX, there are computers, there are electrodes that you use. You can kind of piggyback on somebody else's senses. There's a module which lets you kind of like basically be in someone's body and experience what they're experiencing, but it's less about like, look at this.
So it's like a weird, like biological thing.
Yeah. Well,
are there cyborgs?
It's very cybernetic. It's very much like the boundary between the human, the artificial, the organic, and the cybernetic. So people have like, everyone has various things implanted. I mentioned in my 30 seconds, the psychopath holograph artist, he has like implants in him that allow him to make holograms that look extremely realistic, so much so that you can't tell that they're holograms. And this is like his thing. You can also like, there's also a well-defined though kind of incompletely explained cyberspace. William Gibson came up with that word, by the way. He was the first one to use the word cyberspace.
Seriously? And,
yeah. Yeah, it was him.
Good job, William Gibson.
When was the computer invented? This is 1984. Computer. Well, I mean,
that's kind of a huge question, but like the 80s are when the personal computer were definitely kind of on the rise. Personal computers, computers were on the rise. Apparently, Gibson had
Looks
never
like
1822. Used. He never used a PC. He never used a personal computer when he wrote this.
No, PCs aren't punk rock. Like Gibson is punk rock. Like PCs are not punk rock.
No, not yet.
Someday. Yeah. So it's really interesting because there some of the technology is like familiar. There are certain things like holograms, certain brands. Sony is still around. Hitachi is still around.
No, wait.
But there are other things.
Product
which are,
placement? Do you think?
No, was not it, product placement. It was, no, it's more that he wanted to kind of blend the present. This is not 20,000 years in the future. It doesn't really give a date. I think I'm pretty sure I couldn't find a date when it's supposed to take place. It's more near future. This could be us. This could be soon. 10, 15, 20, 50 years in the future, that kind of thing.
60.
So often in the near future, we get cautionary tales. Like we get dystopias. Is this a dystopia that it takes place in? Like it sounds like there's this uber powerful corporation.
It definitely sounds like it, Joe.
It's weird. That's a really interesting question. That's one I've been kind of batting around.
Does it depend on who you are in their society?
From one perspective. No, I think so this book takes place in a dystopian society, but as a matter of fact, it ends with a degree of hope and trying to keep to keep rule one about spoilers.
Yeah, be careful.
I'm going to avoid spoilers, but I will say that like
it offers
kind of a all throughout the book, human beings are put on display as mostly dreadful. Like there are few kind of good human beings in this book, except for the aforementioned space going Rastafarians. Most of the people here are kind of gross in one way or another. They're psychopaths or they're murderers
or addicts or yeah.
So the hope at the end of this book is maybe it doesn't have to be all humans, and maybe human beings can be replaced or supplanted by something beyond, something evolved, something post-human.
That sounds not very good for us humans.
Well, it's not great for humans, but maybe it's good for humanity.
Right. I mean, if the book's argument is look at how terrible these people are, then and like seriously, there's this creepy family that's kind of at the center of this, it's really a heist at its core. And this family is super wealthy and extremely powerful, and they basically live forever. They use cryonics and cloning, and they direct huge swaths of like global culture, and they're kind of presented as the old way of doing things, and AI is the new way. And
this is relevant.
It is.
Uh-oh. Can this predict the next 5 to 10 years? Specifically on the workforce?
If it's predicting the next 5 to 10 years.
I've been doing some Googling and there's some concerns.
It's predicting that maybe greed, maybe human greed is a really, really bad thing. And maybe AIs would be better because they're not so greedy.
Wow. This is a game changer. Yeah, greed bad. So, what's a necromancer?
What? neuromancer. A necromancer.
What's a necromancer?
A necromancer is.
Let's start with that.
A necromancer is someone who uses magic to raise the dead. And the name of the book is a play on necromancer. But you instead of raising the dead, you raise people's consciousnesses. You're doing magic with people's brains, basically.
I don't know which one sounds more evil.
It's really okay. So the whole book, this is really fascinating because the whole book kind of sets you up to feel like the AIs are bad. Like we should not be, these characters should not be trusting AI. These characters should not be doing what the AI wants them to do, but it kind of turns out in a different direction. People are surprised by the AI and that it's not evil. It's like you're promised a bad computer, and then it's like in 2001 A Space Odyssey if Hal just was like, oh, and also, I'm nice now.
Yeah, Hal's your pal. I don't think I've ever read a book where the AI turns out to not be evil.
Yep, well, here we go. And that is that is a bit of a spoiler, but also it's kind of like that's one of the big points of the book, that this is a way forward.
Wow. Because AI like has humanity's interest in mind more than humanity does, or AI is able to like see the larger picture more than humanity is. Like humans are ruined by greed and smallness and addiction and things like that. And the AI is somehow benevolent above that.
Well, yeah, I think the AI has larger concerns than individual self-preservation and the wielding of power. I think the idea is like original sin. Like human beings have a tendency to put themselves first, and the possibility is that the AI would have a more global, actually global view.
Why do you like this book?
Well, okay, so I guess
besides
I already
it's
said
the first.
I told you the thing about, reading this, I was just blown away because I really feel I've read Ready Player One and I really feel this book is.
Hold on, Ian. Let me ask you this question. Let me phrase this a little bit better for you. Mm-hmm. Let me give you some more meat on this question, as they say.
Meat on the bone.
No, on the question, Joe.
Oh, so, sorry. Sorry.
Does the question have bones?
Oh, yeah.
Does the question have meat?
Guys, please, I'm trying to ask this meaty question. Like when you hear a genre definer, sometimes like these things come out and it's like, it's famous because it was the first, but it wasn't ever necessarily the best. Uh-huh. Does it kind of live up to the hype of it being a game changer book?
I think it does. It does live up to that. Yes. It lives up to that hype.
Should I give you an example?
Please. Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, shoot. I was hoping you would say no.
No, Nick, we're good. Nick,
we've been over this with Dracula. Like you said when we did Dracula, I was kind of claiming that this is kind of a game changer for the vampire and the horror fiction genre. And you were like, yeah, it's fine, but it was just the first. You couldn't get finished. You were a DNF on that one. You did not finish.
Sure.
I think for some people, that's an example. Like, you know it's the first, but is it the best?
You know maybe it's not a big deal, but it's still not good.
Right. It's been rhapsodized upon. It's been refined.
Its value is more in the fact, in its kind of history making. This is the first of its kind. Yeah. Yes, I would say this lives up to the hype. So much of cyberpunk atmosphere is still based on this story. So much of like what cyberpunk can be and can do is based on the aesthetics. The first line of the story famously says the sky over the port was the color of a television tuned to a dead channel. And just it's a beautiful first line. It's just this powerful, well painted aesthetic that cyberpunk today, in whatever form it takes, whether it's the new Matrix movie coming out,
Matrix 4,
or the video game I mentioned,
Cyberpunk 2077,
or Cyberpunk television show on Netflix, Altered Carbon, any of these things are indebted to Neuromancer. And going back to Neuromancer, I'm amazed by how well Neuromancer does it. It didn't predict the rise of cell phones, and that's the only thing it really got wrong. But everything,
oh, no.
Everything else seems really, really prescient, and it could just as easily work today as it did in 1984.
Wow.
We see faceless megacorporations having increasing kind of technocratic control of uncontrollable parts of our lives, the things we thought were uncontrollable. Like, did you guys know that Target has algorithms that can predict that you're having a baby before you know?
I've heard this. I've heard that like people had their birth announcement, for example, ruined by targeted advertising that somebody came across, you know, like their mother came across.
That's how I found out.
You're looking at
Target
Annie's phone.
Target said, like, congratulations.
Wait, what is this?
Yeah, honey. Honey, have you been shopping at Target?
It's just like this is one example. And there was a high profile case where a guy actually sued Target because he felt there was an invasion of privacy when all it really was is he gave them access to his data and his family's data. And it turned out his daughter was pregnant. And Target knew. And
they're not a sponsor, are they?
Target. No, I don't think this week.
Can we look into that?
Yeah, just double check. We'll look into it.
Okay.
But we also see things like skyrocketing homelessness and transiency and poverty. We see ecological collapse. We see Boston Dynamics has a robot which dances to pop music from the 60s. Like, this is now. Mm-hmm. This is what was near future is becoming present.
Do you think that algorithm, do you think like it's as simple as, hey, this girl bought a pregnancy test at Target, we're going to send you like baby cribs? Nah. Or do you think it's more complex than this?
Oh, it's more complex.
I would think it's probably significantly more complex than that, Joe.
No, I think that might be it. I think this targeted advertising smoke and mirror, guys. You know what? It's funny that you talk about not predicting the rise of cell phones. The Matrix had this same problem. Like, if you've seen The Matrix lately, payphones are a central plot point in that movie.
It really is the thing you have to avoid for that movie to make sense.
If that movie came out 2 years later, you'd be like, what the fuck are they doing with payphones? Like, what is going on?
Yeah. You guys ever heard of splatterpunk?
No. What is splatterpunk?
No.
Splatterpunk is a movement within horror fiction originating in the 1980s, distinguished by its graphic, often gory, depiction of violence, counterculture, and blah, blah, blah. Horror.
Great.
A lot of punks. A whole universe of punks out there.
Well, and I think it's easy
nanopunk,
to...
Nanopunk? There's nanopunk, biopunk, dieselpunk, cyberpunk, space.
Oh, like dieselpunk sounds awesome.
This is obnoxious.
Well, that's like Mad Max, right? I think...
Yes.
Yes. I think it's kind of like the suffix gate. In politics, you add gate to something that's a controversy, so... And I think punk is the same way. But Gibson was actually like, he put the punk in cyberpunk. When he was in danger of being drafted for the Vietnam War, he went up in front of the draft board and he said to them, "Yeah, so what are my goals? I'm going to try every drug that exists, every drug that I can." And they said to him, "You know what? We don't want to draft you."
Well, I always get the sense that when something gets like the punk addendum, what does that tell you? Is that it's going to be like a little dirtier, like a little grittier? Because when I think of cyberpunk, I do think of it's not like a clean future. It's a future with rain and city streets and smog, neon. Right? Like it's a dirty future.
Diesel punk sounds clean.
No, diesel punk sounds filthy. Steampunk sounds a little clean, I think. That sounds a little squeaky.
Well, I think you could define our book as butler punk.
I think that's the only possible way to define it.
Yeah. Genre definer.
Genre definer. That's us. Game changer.
Why didn't we bring too many butlers? That would be...
Well, we haven't wrote it yet.
Or no, that's a great point.
Even any of it yet.
Oh, we've written, I think, one part of it where Dwayne The Rock Johnson has a sleeveless tuxedo. We got to keep working on that.
That writes itself, though. You don't even need to write that.
I want to make 2 points about this book kind of before I wrap up. And these are some of the things that as I dug into the mythos of this novel, it's more and more fascinating. So this is the only novel to ever win the Triple Crown of Sci-Fi, which is the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, and the Philip K. Dick Award. Wow. And the last one is particularly impressive because this was published. It was published as a paperback. And so it kind of had this pulp vibe. And it still won these are the awards. Dune also won the Hugo and the Nebula, but not the Philip K. Dick Award.
Not the third.
Not the third. The other thing.
Oof.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's like a direct to like DVD movie winning an Oscar or something. It's like that's a big deal.
Right, made for TV.
So no Oscars for you, Joe.
Not yet.
The other thing that I really love, he wrote this book. He wrote the first third of it, and then he went to see the film Blade Runner. And he was like, dang it, everyone's going to think I cribbed from that. Everyone's going to think I stole it. So he rewrote the first section 12 times. And then he finished writing it, and he kind of wrote it in this frantic fervor because he realized he needed to write a novel if he was going to be an author, but he was concerned he couldn't. So he wrote it, and then he finished it, and then he went back and added one sentence, and it's the last sentence of the book. And the reason he wrote this final sentence, which is, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's a very kind of final sentence.
This is a real teasing little tidbit that you're sharing with us. Keep
he
going.
Wrote this because imagine he said, I don't, he said, I don't want to write a sequel. He wrote this final sentence because it closes off the possibility of a sequel. And he said in this moment, I want this thing to stand alone. I want it to be its own work. No sequels. Let it ride.
He's got to kill somebody in the last sentence then.
Nope,
what's
he doesn't.
Your guess?
Oh boy, what's his guess? And then the world exploded and everybody died.
Which is not the case for Too Many Butlers. That is never, that's going to be a series that never ends.
Nope. You ever hear of Bond?
It's like Fast and the Furious. That shit's not going
anywhere. We can introduce the new villain for the next book in the last sentence of each book.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
That's great. So guys, there are these places in which lots of people are close together in small quantities of land. They're called big cities.
You're talking about bars.
No, bigger.
Taverns?
Bigger.
Concert Inns. Venues.
Bigger. Like much bigger. Think taller. Bigger.
The moon.
Smaller. Colder. I was thinking like cities.
Dentist offices. Oh, cities. Yeah, okay.
Do you guys have any books that take places in cities? This is such a stupid theme.
Yeah,
big
couple.
Cities? That's the theme we want to pick? So, Ian, I'm a small town man. Joe, as you know,
just a
also
small
town
girl living in a lonely world. Are we going to do journeys again?
No, let's do some books that take place in a city. Which is, I don't think, probably a compelling theme for anybody, but I think it will get us to the books that we want to talk about. So what do you guys think about that?
I think that's a great idea. Joe?
Yeah. Hey, Nick, I do have a big city book for you. I, in fact, have a book from Milwaukee's older, cooler brother. I'm, of course, talking about Chicago, just down the coast. I have a book called Native Son, set on the south side of Chicago in a time. Well, you'll have to wait and see. Native Son, south side of Chicago, and it is a big city book, if whatever that means, if I've ever heard of one.
Yeah. Do you have any big city books, big city? I'm going to start calling you guys both big city.
That's scary. I have a book, which is going to be very confusing to both of you guys.
Great.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's called Invisible Man. You're probably going to make a billion stupid jokes about how this is the H.G. Wells story about the guy who becomes invisible. It's not.
The Invisible Man.
Right. This is not The Invisible Man. This is Invisible Man. It's by Ralph Ellison. And part of it takes place in the American South, but then most of it takes place in New York City, which is a big city if I ever heard of one.
It's also Black History Month. So all month long, we're doing black authors.
Mm-hmm. Black authors or books about black history. Yes.
Joe, in about 7 to 8 months, Dune comes out. Uh-huh. So I'm really glad you brought this.
If the world hasn't turned into whatever.
Into Dune. There's a better chance that Dune exists in real life quicker than the movie comes out.
Oh, man. So I am so excited to talk about this book, but also really nervous because Ian, as you know, Ian, the hardest books to talk about on this show are books that you actually in your heart love. True or false?
Absolutely.
It's so tough.
Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Stop bringing me books you don't love.
Nick, we can't love them all.
I don't think Joe's or my psyche could stand up to the strain of that.
Oh, it is. Bringing books that you love to this show is such a harrowing experience because you want to do them justice.
You know you're going
to
fail. Yeah.
Yeah. It's impossible. Like the constraints of this show are absolutely impossible to convey something worthwhile.
Those are my standards, Joe.
That's okay.
Impossible to meet.
Perfect.
The last time Joe was this excited about a book was The Right Stuff, which genuinely got me excited. So,
yes.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go.
So live up to that.
Okay. Nick, I'm going to do my best. I do think it's going to save us some time if you tell us like Neuromancer is a book that I had never heard of before.
Yeah, I know
before
nothing about
Ian
it.
Brought it. But Dune, I would imagine you do know something about. Like it's a book that kind of percolates in the back of pop culture our entire lives. What do you know about it?
Yeah, here's what I know. So big underground worms, which is a weird sci-fi thing that takes place in a lot of movies. I do know that in books. I saw the movie in the 80s.
Oh, did you? Okay.
The brilliant masterpiece by David Lynch.
Starring the unofficial and official mascot of this podcast, Kyle MacLachlan. I'm claiming that right now. Kyle, we know you're listening. Give us a call. Shoot us an email. We'd love to have your face as the logo for this show.
I think Patrick Stewart is also in that movie. Can we reach out to him as well? I would really love to meet Patrick Stewart, guys.
I thought we were only selecting dead celebrities to endorse this show. So maybe Patrick Stewart.
I'm not saying this is an endorsement. I'm just floating the idea to our good friend and loyal lithead, Kyle.
Fan of the show, Kyle.
If you would like to.
What else? There's sand.
Yep.
Sand. There's a box you put your hand in.
Oh, yeah, there is.
There's spice.
Spice of life. That's all I know. This is what I think about this book. Mm-hmm. I think there is no way a movie's going to live up to this book.
That's
my understanding. I believe this is a book that doesn't transfer to the movie screen.
Well, okay. I think that's a pretty good take. And I think the track record yeah. Of everybody who's ever tried to do this might give you some credence. People, as you probably know, have tried to make this into a film a couple of times. The famous example is 1980s. There was also the David Lynch movie, which is just universally panned.
Oof. I thought it was a cult favorite.
Yeah, it's a very small cult.
There was also an attempt made in the 70s that what was the guy's name? Jabakowski, something like
Jodorowsky,
that?
Alejandro Jodorowsky, yeah.
Yeah, and it's very frequently called the best movie never made. I guess there were just like thousands and thousands and thousands of storyboards for it. They had this fully realized thing, and nobody would fund it. They're like, this is impossible.
There's a really good documentary about that project called Jodorowsky's Dune, which I would highly recommend. It's really interesting.
Still not as good as the book because it never happened.
So when I read
Point
this
for
book,
Nick,
I have Ian, you and I talked about this a little bit on a different episode or maybe off air, where we talked about like trying to read Dune a couple of times and just bouncing off of it entirely.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Like getting into like those first few pages even and just going, what the hell is going on
yep.
here? It is this universe, this fully realized universe that you are absolutely just thrown into the deep end of. And that is yeah. with all of its planets and its feudal empire system and its politics and its subterfuge. Like you are just thrown into the middle of things and made to figure things out. And that is tough. Like it's really tough to do, but I think like Ian with Neuromancer, I got to a certain point in this book and I think it was a little farther than 20 or 30 pages in, but not too far. It wasn't 100 pages. And all of a sudden things clicked for me. And as soon as those things clicked for me, I was bought in. Like this universe was just a place that I wanted to hang out in.
What was it?
Well, let me give you just a bit of the stage.
So why do I even ask you questions?
I should
just say, what's your next thing you want to talk at me?
Well, I want to give you a bit of plot just so that we aren't just talking
Fine.
About
give
so
me
we
some,
know more
give me
than
some of your
worms
plot.
And box and sand and 1980s film starring
David Lynch.
And,
yeah.
Okay. So there's this guy. He's a duke. His name is Duke Leto, and he's moving up in the empire. He has been given control of this desert planet called Arrakis, sometimes called Dune. And the thing that you need to know about Arrakis, Dune, is that it is a brutal, brutal place to live. There are unheard of windstorms, these like giant sandworms that have like the best kill death ratio in the universe. But it's also a super important planet for the Empire because it is the only place in the universe where they can mine spice. And spice is this, I guess
it's a metaphor.
Well, it's definitely a metaphor. It's also a drug. It's a drug that makes you like fire on all cylinders. It gives you this super heightened awareness. It's kind of like Adderall, except it extends your life. Like it's kind of good for you and makes you fully realize your human potential. It's also pretty addictive. So Duke Leto moves to Arrakis with his family. His family consists of this young son, Paul, and his wife, Jessica, and the rest of his court. And they move into Arrakis to essentially set up shop.
I like how normal their names are.
That is actually one of the more jarring
Arrakis,
things.
Arrakis, I am Jessica.
Oh, yeah. And if you like weird names, I think they give Paul and Jessica normal names. You spend a lot of time with those characters. I think they give them normal names because there is nothing else in this book that has a normal name. Like it's like the Madhuib and the Bene Gesserit.
He's the Quisar Sadarach.
He's the Quisar Sadarach. Like it's stuff like that just throughout.
So you can remember their names. That's good.
Just to interject here for a second, I feel like this is maybe a handle that these big kind of mythopoeic world building stories do. They give you normal names for their characters to hang on to when everything else, because I'm thinking about how Game of Thrones does this.
Yeah. Like, so they, even with, though like, their the characters have names.
Really long, complicated names like Daenerys Targaryen, you shorten it to Danny, and all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, it's a normal name.
Yeah, it gives you something concrete to hold on to in this world where, like, you just are lost for a big part. Like, so even if you don't know what the hell is going on with the Bene Gesserit on Arrakis, you do know who Paul is. So when they say the name Paul, you're like, oh, great.
I understood one word in this sentence.
Is this a thinly veiled, like, anti-Muslim or anti-Iraq thing?
What are the racial undertones, Joe?
No,
It's a sand planet where they mine a very valuable substance that needs to keep the world going, and it's called Arrakis.
Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing the connection.
No, I don't. Ian, I don't get it.
Good try, though.
It does bring me to.
I think they're talking about variety.
You guys are doing really well.
So they're trying to find the Red Bull.
Without going too much more into the plot, because the plot is like sprawling and convoluted and it has like feints upon feints upon feints. One of the things is the Fremen. The Fremen are the native population of Arrakis. They are a tribe, like they're super tribal in structure. And while everybody else is dying on Arrakis, like, this planet is a dangerous, dangerous place. Like, the sandworms are super dangerous. The windstorms are super dangerous. There's no water on this planet, so everybody wears these suits that harvest all the moisture from your body. So, like, it captures your breath when you breathe so that you don't spend that moisture into the air. Like, it captures your urine and recycles it and so that you're never losing it.
Gross.
Super gross.
Really disgusting.
But on this planet that is just incredibly hostile to all living life, like, the Fremen are thriving. Like, they are this tribe who absolutely revere water, who have total mastery of these sandworms, who are like very like kind of like religious and in like their structures. But like, they thrive on Arrakis.
So they're the Tusken Raiders.
Okay.
They're the Tusken Raiders.
Yeah. Can we talk about Star Wars for a second?
You know, nobody ever does. So it's high time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. About time.
So this book came out in 1965. It contains, as you heard in my 30-second summary, space travel, swords, energy shields, a galactic empire, a hokey religion that proves more powerful than any naysayer imagined. Like, a lot of, like, takes place on a desert planet, has a massive worm that eats people, right? Like, a lot of people point at this, like, they look at Tatooine, they look at Star Wars, and they say, hey, George, this looks kind of familiar, don't you think? I think one of the things that the value in this book is, and I think, like, the reason it takes a little while to get into is because the action isn't the point of this book. The world is the point of this book, and like hanging out in this world, the lore, the backstories. We've talked in the past when talking, I think, about Lord of the Rings, where you get these little details or these little side stories that are so interesting and so fully realized that you get the sense that even though they just appear on the page, you know, for a paragraph or a sentence or a couple of words, you get the sense that there is a fully realized backstory and often a fully realized appendix behind it that you like want to follow. So you'll get this character on stage who's a minor character, but like when he disappears for 8 years and comes back, like you want to know everything that happened to him in those 8 years. Like you want to like have another book that follows him and like watches as he hangs out with these smugglers.
Okay, so there's 8 of these Dune books. You read the first one, which was a quote-unquote game changer.
Yes.
I've heard that some of these books really suck. So
okay.
My question is, what's going on here? Do I need to continue reading these books? Am I missing something if I don't read them all? How much suffering has to take place for me to enjoy this book and book series?
So there's this series called the Wheel of Time series. Ian, have you read any of these?
I am regretful to say that I got about 9 books in and then
oh, Jesus,
had no more will. to continue.
There is, how long is the Wheel of Time series?
So this is a series which has outlived its author. Robert Jordan died before it was finished. I think he died when he had finished book 12. And these are not small books. These books are 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 pages long each. Huge investment of time.
So what were you thinking at 8 books, Ian? You're like, one more.
I was thinking.
Lucky it's kind number of the, 9.
It's like the reverse of the gambler's thing. Like, surely my luck will change. Surely. it is the gambler's thing.
Yeah, it is the gambler's thing.
Next one. I just gotta wait for my number to come up.
There's 8 books in the series, as you've said. But the thing is having read Dune, I have no ambition to read the next book in the series. I do.
that's not a real recommendation there, Joe.
That sounds like a bad thing, Joe.
I want to reread this book. Like, that's what I want to do. Like, knowing what I know about the universe now, like, as you've pieced it all together, or as I pieced it all together throughout the, 20-hour audiobook that this was, I want to start back at the beginning and revisit that first page that was totally incomprehensible to me the very first time I read this. Like, I want to, spend more time in this world with these characters. Will I read the other ones? Yeah, maybe someday in the future, if I really dig it. But, I do want to reread this one.
Ian's author's like, here's one sentence. I'm never writing another one. And Frank Herbert's like, I'm going to write these the rest of my life.
Yep, absolutely. He was.
Is this book tedious?
Never. I think, honest to God, never was this book tedious. I will say, I got it on audiobook, and I think that was a game changer if there ever was one. The audiobook is fully casted. It's fully voice acted. It really makes the reading experience a heck of a lot easier. And it helps you follow.
I love it when Audible does that. They do such good work over at Audible.
Audible.com. It's fully realized. And it never felt tedious to me.
Joe.
Yes.
Can you talk about the religious aspect of it? Because that's a part that feels maybe, that's one of the parts that feels the most old fashioned to me about this book.
Yeah. Okay. So the plot is moved by really surprising things. The plot is moved by sociology, it's moved by politics, it's moved by subterfuge, and it's definitely moved by religion. Without getting too much into the plot, there is the Fremen have this prophecy that they believe is going to be fulfilled. And the family of Duke Leto turns out to be really central to that prophecy. Boy, I don't know how to do this without getting into 2 appendixes worth of stuff.
Ian, you seem to know the answer to the question you asked. Do you want to just tell us what religion is about this?
Well, it's just I think a lot of times, it feels to me like a lot of times, it's been a long time, so Joe, please jump in and correct me as you see fit. A lot of times when there's a prophecy and a chosen one in a story, it kind of...
Let's just say Neo, for example.
Yeah, like a Neo or a Harry Potter or whatever it is. These are kind of just like, oh yeah, prophecies exist, but we're going to move on from the mechanisms of that. We're going to get to the fact that this person is the savior. This person is the chosen one. But as I recall it, it's not just kind of like in Dune, our chosen one has to say yes, that's me, I'm chosen. And then everyone believes him. There is a whole process of determining and maybe training. And it's just really interesting that it's a book that decides to play with the trope of the chosen one, but it also gives it a real kind of well-developed background environment in which people would actually believe in a chosen one. If someone out of the blue says, oh yeah, there's a prophecy that so-and-so is the chosen one. If you don't have any reason to believe that, you're going to be what? Why? Who cares? But if you have a sort of a belief system that makes that matter, then the chosen one all of a sudden becomes that much more important. So that's one of the things that stood out to me about this book. And
you're dead on. There's 2 cool things about it. Jessica. And is trained in this way. Jessica, one of our main characters.
Jessica, friend of the show.
Jessica is a Bene Gesserit. And what Bene Gesserit is it's kind of like this girls' school that you would send your highborn daughter to, in which she would learn some like kind of political, kind of like super empathy, like kind of mystical ways. Like it's not magic, but it's like being able to read people and influence people to the level that it might as well be magic.
So she's going to PR.
She's
learning public relations.
Here's the thing. She comes from a PR school that has been around for millennia. Bene Gesserit, they've been around forever, and they have their own kind of motives. They have their own end goals.
This is the nerdiest thing I've ever heard.
Oh, it's so nerdy.
Fucking ridiculously nerdy. What?
So they...
This seems like... Now, can we expect the Star Wars treatment on this series, Joe? We're going to get a movie soon this year.
Yeah,
and
so we...
Are we going to get the Star Wars treatment in which we have 20 more movies coming out, 16 miniseries on HBO Max, and we're going to get to learn every single part of the appendix of this book? Is that what we can expect, do you think?
Well, I think that the success of the movie coming out later this year is going to answer that question one way or the other for you. I am kind of excited for this movie. I know it's never been done well before. There's a couple things that are going well. They aren't trying to do the whole story in one movie, which, you know, we've seen that go poorly, like with The Hobbit, for example. But
wait, so they're not covering the first book?
They are covering the first half of the first book.
That'll be really disappointing.
No, I think it'll be cool.
It's going to end with a freeze frame as a sandworm pops out of the ground. And Paul Atreides turns and looks at the camera and says, "You're probably wondering how I get out of this one. Well, tune in 3 years."
You got it. That's exactly how it's going to go. The other thing is I'm really excited for the director. It's the same guy that did Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, he's fucking great.
And Arrival, which I think is awesome. So I'm pumped.
Yeah, no, but my boy Dennis, he should do it right. Sweet. While I deliberate, do you guys want to hawk this show?
Hey, litheads. We've been talking about changing the game a lot today. If you want to change the game.
We had a lot of fun here today, guys.
It's time to get serious.
Nick, you're deliberate.
Litheads, if you want to change the game, you can share a book recommendation with us. Head on over to our social media at You Don't Know Lit on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can head over to the website, which is youdontknowlitpodcast.com, and you can tell us what to do. You can tell us what books to read. You can suggest things. You know the drill.
Man, this is a tough one. As usual, I wasn't really deliberating. I was just listening to what you guys were saying intently.
I don't think we should play tricks on the lit head like that.
Okay. Now I'll really deliberate.
The groaning noise of deliberation.
That's the noise that Nick makes when he thinks, which is number one, why lit heads, you've never heard it before. And number two, why he struggled in school.
Nick is getting out his coin flip app.
I think I want to read Dune.
I think you should. I think you should get it on audiobook. It's awesome.
I've heard more bad things about Dune than I have about Neuromancer. So that's concerning. But it's more popular.
Yeah.
So that's why I want to read it.
I think Dune is...
Which is pretty flawed as a decision mechanism. But here we are. All right, Joe, why don't you quote the nerdiest ass shit you can possibly...
I just want to apologize to Turi. Apparently, when I bring reader requested books, we lose. So sorry, Turi, and sorry, Chris, from last week. Here's where we're at.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing: we don't play favorites.
If this show is one thing, it's fair.
Also, I didn't realize that was happening.
Jeez, way to punish the lit heads.
Punishing the lit heads. That's what we do.
I've brought probably the most famous quote from Dune. It features prominently in the trailer, if you've seen the trailer for the film coming out, and it is about fear. Paul says, "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain."